This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, professor of television studies at Rowan University in New Jersey, in for Terry Gross. Halloween is Monday, and today we're kicking off a two-part series of shows to get us in the spirit. We begin with two guests who love to scare us and do it brilliantly, Stephen King and Jordan Peele. We begin with King. Lots of King's books have been made into films or TV series, including Misery, Carrie, The Shining, Salem's Lot, The Stand, The Dead Zone, Pet Sematary, Castle Rock, and Firestarter. Terry spoke with him in 1992 about his book Gerald's Game. A slight warning here, there are some descriptions that may be unsuitable for children. The book was long thought to be unfilmable, but eventually was released as a movie by Netflix in 2017. As the book opens, a married couple is in their forest cabin. They're ready to play an S&M sex game. She's on the bed, and her wrists are cuffed to the bedposts. She realizes she's tired of this game, but she can't get her husband to stop. As he forces himself on her, she kicks him where it hurts most. He collapses, suffers a heart attack, and dies. And she's alone, cuffed to the bed in the middle of the woods. Now, the horror really begins. Terry asked King what made him think about how corny sex games can be.
Actually, Gerald's Game started with the concept of the woman being chained to the bed. I'd written a book before where a woman and a small child were stuck in a car that was sort of surrounded, if you will, by a rabid St. Bernard. That book was called Cujo. And essentially, what a lot of that book was two people in a very small room, although it did have a shifting perspective so that it went to other characters. And I thought, originally, this was the takeoff point for the book. Wouldn't it be interesting to see what would happen if you had one character in a room? The question then became, what caused this woman to be in this room by herself? And the answer that I came up with was bondage. She's handcuffed to a bed. And that forced me to sort of consider what causes people to do this sort of thing. And so once I'd set up the situation, I knew what it was going to be. I went in and read a little bit about it and thought a little bit about it. And the whole thing struck me as a little bit Victorian. There was something very snidely whiplash about the whole thing, and I tried to get that into the book.
Well, you do in a very funny way. I mean, the husband says to his wife as she's handcuffed to the bedpost, he says, "I'll teach you me proud beauty."
Yes, exactly.
Pronouncing beauty the way the landlord in a bad Victorian melodrama might.
You can almost see him waxing his mustaches, can't you?
Right, right, right. So you got the corniness and the danger of this kind of S&M sex play. Let's get Stephen King to the kind of gore and terror and suspense that you create. There's a scene in Gerald's Game, your new novel, that I'd like you to read from. And this is a scene in which the wife is still handcuffed to the bedpost. Her husband is laying dead on the floor, and a stray vicious dog from the area has walked into the house and has started dining on the woman's dead husband. Would you read it for us?
I sure will. Gerald's widow's peak was in disarray, probably as a result of the dog's licking the blood out of it. But his glasses were still firmly in place. She could see his eyes, half open and glazed, glaring up from their puffy sockets at the fading sun ripples on the ceiling. His face was still a mask of ugly red and purple blotches, as if even death had not been able to assuage his anger at her sudden capricious. Had he seen it as capricious? Of course he had. Change of mind. "Let go of him," she told the dog, but her voice was now meek and sad and strengthless. The dog barely twitched its ears at the sound of it and didn't pause at all. It merely went on pulling the thing with the disarrayed widow's peak and the blotchy complexion. This thing no longer looked like Disco Gerald, not a bit. Now it was only dead Gerald, sliding across the bedroom floor with a dog's teeth buried in its flabby biceps. A frayed flap of skin hung over the dog's snout. Jessie tried to tell herself it looked like wallpaper, but wallpaper did not, at least as far as she knew, come with moles and a vaccination scar. Now she could see Gerald's pink, fleshy belly, marked only by the small caliber bullet hole that was his navel, His penis flopped and dangled in its nest of black pubic hair. His buttocks whispered along the hardwood boards with ghastly, frictionless ease. Abruptly, the suffocating atmosphere of her terror was pierced by a shaft of anger so bright it was like a stroke of heat lightning inside her head. She did more than accept this new emotion. She welcomed it. Rage might not help her get out of this nightmarish situation, but she sensed it would serve as an antidote to her growing sense of shocked unreality. "You bastard," she said in a low, trembling voice. "You cowardly, slinking bastard."
That's Stephen King reading from his novel, Gerald's Game. Do you think of yourself as having taken the horror novel to a kind of more physically explicit place than it had ever been before?
Yeah, I think that to some degree I did do that. I think probably I've been surpassed in that area by some of the people who've come after me. I'm thinking mostly of Clive Barker.
Yeah.
But you realize that when I started reading and experiencing horror, some of it that I was reading and experiencing came from a very graphic wellspring. And I'm thinking about the horror comics of the 1950s, things like Tales from the Crypt and the Vault of Horror that can now be seen on home box office. And at the same time, I was discovering horror movies. I usually went by myself in the afternoon to the Highway Theater in Stratford, Connecticut, which is still there, incidentally, and saw things like I Was a Teenage Werewolf with Michael Landon, or I Was a Teenage Frankenstein, or whatever it happened to be. And it was there that I started to see that it might be possible to combine some of the classic elements with some of the things that I was seeing in the schlock press and the schlock movies.
When you would see movies like this, did they scare you or just amuse you?
No, they scared me. You have to remember that we're talking 10 or 11 years old, and even with a picture like Teenage Monster, where the flying saucer appeared to be a cool cigarette filter tip with a sparkler stuck in it, that it looked real to me because I was at a young and very credulous age. And one of the other things that I sensed as time went past and I got a little more discriminating in my ability to detect special effects, if not necessarily my sense of taste, was that when I wrote it, you never saw the zipper going up the monster's back, that when the imagination was in charge of special effects, they were always perfect as the book was, anyway.
Mm-hmm. What did you like about being scared when you were young?
I liked the total surrender of emotional control. It was very important to me, and I would almost be willing to say sort of a lifesaver. I'd been raised in a family where emotional control was a really important thing. You weren't supposed to show you were afraid. You weren't supposed to show that you were in pain or frightened or sad. Happiness was permissible as long as it didn't go too far, because then one might be considered to be almost insane if one got too happy. So that emotional control was, you know, sort of a requirement. And all the movies, my brother, David, was crazy about Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin. That was his emotional release. It's all a form of emotional seduction. And for me, the terror was what really appealed to something that I think is probably just inside people, that there isn't any logical way to explain it. But I loved it, and I loved giving up that control.
Now, what about when you passed real terror? I mean, for instance, if you would pass a car accident, would you look or turn the other way?
I can't remember that a lot of that ever happened in my life. What I can remember is making a very clear and conscious differentiation between make-believe horror like I Was a Teenage Werewolf and something real that happened. When I was a kid, at around the same time that Michael Landon was playing that werewolf, the make-believe werewolf, there was a kid named Charlie Starkweather who took his girlfriend, Carol Ann Fugate, and the two of them went on a killing spree across the Midwest. They killed, I don't know, 10 or 11 people in Nebraska and then over in Wyoming where they were captured. And he was put to death in the electric chair. And I kept a scrapbook about these people. You know, I would cut out the items and paste them in this scrapbook that I had. And my mother was very disturbed about it. This was in the mid-50s, and it was a time when child psychology was not exactly in vogue. But I think that if it had been, she probably would have sent me to one. I think that I can remember her saying, why are you interested in these people, Stephen? What is it? And what I was not able to explain at 10 or 11 years old was, I want to know these people if I ever run into them. Not because they attract me, but because they scare the hell out of me. I want to know what the real beast in the real world looks like so I can steer clear of him or her or them.
Stephen King speaking to Terry Gross in 1992. After a break, more with Stephen King from 2013. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's listen now to Terry's 2013 interview with Stephen King about his novel Joyland. It's set at an amusement park called Joyland in 1973. The novel combines elements of crime, horror, and the supernatural. The main character is a college student who takes a job at this amusement park where he enters a different world. They began with King reading from the novel.
I stashed my basket of dirty rags and turtle wax by the exit door in the arcade. It was 10 past noon, but right then food wasn't what I was hungry for. I walked slowly along the track and into Horror House. I had to duck my head when I passed beneath the screaming skull, even though it was now pulled up and locked in its home position. My footfalls echoed on a wooden floor painted to look like stone. I could hear my breathing. It sounded harsh and dry. I was scared, okay? Tom had told me to stay away from this place, but Tom didn't run my life any more than Eddie Parks did. Between the dungeon and the torture chamber, the track descended and described a double S-curve where the cars picked up speed and whipped the riders back and forth. Horror House was a dark ride, but when it was in operation, this stretch was the only completely dark part. It had to be where the girl's killer had cut her throat and dumped her body. How quick he must have been, and how certain of exactly what he was going to do. I walked slowly down the double S, thinking it would not be beyond Eddie to hear me and shut off the overhead work lights as a joke, to leave me here to feel my way past the murder site with only the sound of the wind and that one slapping board to keep me company. And suppose, just suppose, a young girl's hand reached out in that darkness and took mine.
That's Stephen King reading from his new novel, Joyland. So this is a crime novel that's set in an amusement park in North Carolina. But there's also an element of the supernatural in it. Why did an amusement park that's kind of very carny seem like a good opportunity to combine crime and the supernatural?
Well, I always wanted to write a novel set in an amusement park. And in the original concept of The Shining, that was going to be a family that was caretaking an amusement park at the close of the season.
And instead of an old hotel.
Instead of an old hotel, yeah. And I had a title for the book. I was going to call it Dark Shine. And I think I had a name for the amusement park, too. It might have been Skyhook or something like that, named after one of the rides. Ever since I was a little boy and I went to the Topsom Fair, I've loved the rides and the barkers. I think those people in particular, the shy bosses, they're called. They're the people who turn the tips. They're the ones who stand out in front and tell you, you know, everybody wins, folks. Everybody wins. Come on over. It's just a quarter of a dollar and everybody wins. Hey, mister, you want to win this big stuffy toy for your girlfriend? She's a beauty and she deserves, you know, that kind of thing. In a way, it's a little bit like revival preachers, but in a secular version. So I've always been kind of fascinated by those things and in love with it. And I just kind of wanted to visit that world for a while. I had an idea for the story, which, by the way, has been in my head for about 20 years now. And all it was, to begin with, was an image of a boy in a wheelchair flying a kite on a beach. And that picture was just as clear in my mind as it could be. And it wanted to be a story, but it wasn't a story. It was just a picture, as clear, as clear, as clear. And little by little, the story built itself around it. And I thought, well, there's an amusement park down the beach from where this kid in the wheelchair is trying to fly his kite. And the name of the amusement park is Joyland.
So you mentioned the boy in the wheelchair was the first image that came to you, and that boy in the novel is a 10-year-old named Mike who has muscular dystrophy, but a special kind, which usually kills you in your early teens or 20s. But Mike has the sight. What is the power that he has?
He has a power to see a little bit beyond this world, and he has a very small talent compared to some of the other characters in books that I've written. He's got a little bit of precognition.
When you were in your formative years, what were your supernatural fears, and did you always wish you had some of the supernatural powers that you've given some of your characters?
I think it's built in. I think it's just part of human nature. I've been queried a lot about where I get my ideas or how I got interested in this stuff. And at some point, a lot of interviewers just turn into Dr. Freud and put me on the couch and say, what was your childhood like? And I say various things and I confabulate a little bit and kind of dance around the question as best as I can. But bottom line, my childhood was pretty ordinary, except from a very early age, I wanted to be scared. I just did. I was scared. Afterwards, I wanted a light on because I was afraid that there was something in the closet. My imagination was very active, even at a young age. For instance, there was a radio program at that time called Dimension X, and my mother didn't really want me to listen to that because she felt it was too scary for me. So I would creep out of bed and go to the bedroom door and crack it open, and she loved it, so apparently I got it from her, but I would listen at the door, and then when the program was over, I'd go back to bed and quake.
So you wanted to be scared? Or, I mean, did you have an avoidance thing with being scared, or did you just want to be scared?
Terry, I loved it. It was a classic attraction-repulsion thing. I wanted to be scared. I wanted that reaction.
Are there things that scare you as an adult that you were not aware enough of or smart enough for when you were a kid to understand that these were frightening things?
Well, you grow up and you become frightened of different things, and they have a tendency to be real-world things.
Yeah.
It's been quite a while since I was really afraid that there was a boogeyman in my closet. Although I am still very careful to keep my feet under the covers when I go to sleep, because the covers are magic, and if your feet are covered, it's like boogeyman kryptonite. So I'm not as afraid of that as I used to be. The supernatural stuff doesn't get to me anymore. But here's the movie that scared me the most in the last 12 or 13 years. The movie opens with a woman in late middle age sitting at a table and writing a story. And the story goes something like, then the branches creaked in the, and she stops and she says to her husband, what are those things? I can't think of them. They're in the backyard and they're very tall and birds land on the branches. And he says, why, Iris, those are trees. And she says, yes, how silly of me. And she writes the word and the movie starts. That's Iris Murdoch, and she's suffering the onset of Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah.
That's the boogeyman in the closet now.
Why is that the thing you're most afraid of?
I'm afraid of losing my mind.
Losing your memory?
Mm-hmm. Well, you don't just lose your memory. You lose your mind, basically.
Yeah.
You lose your identity, your sense of who you are. Here's what I'm saying. As we get older, our fears in some way sharpen and become more personal because we can no longer, let's say, take a book like It or maybe Christine and say, these are make-believe fears. Instead, we have more of a tendency to focus on things that we know are out there. We fear for our families. We fear for our mental abilities. We fear for diseases. These are very real fears. So when you ask me what I'm afraid of, I'd say I still go to see ghost movies when I get a chance, or some sort of supernatural being, that kind of thing. But it doesn't scare me as it scared me when I was a child. But on the other hand, if I see a wonderful writer like Iris Murdoch losing her mind, I have more of a tendency to focus on that than how loving her husband was, which is supposed to be the uplifting part of that film.
Stephen King recorded in 2013. His latest novel is called Fairy Tale. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.